And this is the 6th of November, 1979. Winter is a coming. Well, we finished up our book of Genesis last week. And I had a suggestion from somebody over the telephone, we go in and take up Exodus. But I don't think we'll read through the whole book of Exodus, everything. I think rather we'll take up the subject of the Exodus itself and the entry into the land. In other words, we will take the wilderness experience and then the entrance into the land under Joshua. Exodus itself has the idea of redemption, although the word in the English means to go out. And it is the going out of Egypt by Israel. And Moses effected the Exodus, but Joshua effected the Isodus. And that's the going in. So they came out of Egypt and went into the promised land, the Exodus and the Isodus. The book of Exodus is interesting in many ways. We have a great deal of possibly what we call allegory or type, whichever you want to call it. And some of it may be one, some of it the other, which is interesting. It has been suggested that this period of Israel's history is pictured by Psalms 88 and 89. Which, of course, are really messianic prophecies, but they do fit in with the subject. And, of course, you're probably aware of the fact that the Psalms are divided into five divisions, each one being a representation, at least, of one of the books of the Pentateuch, taking it through Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, five books, and so the book of Exodus is divided into that, and when one reads it carefully and looks at those divisions, you can see that there is very much of a similarity there, and it does mark off these five divisions of Exodus to a great extent, the Pentateuch, I mean, but a great extent. Now, starting in with Exodus 1:1, and probably this would be a good title to the book. Now, these are the names. Because through Exodus, we have a lot of names. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt. Every man in his household came with Jacob. I notice this is naming the ones who came into Egypt. You don't find Joseph's name in this bunch because he's already in Egypt. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun. There are six sons of Leah. And Benjamin, a son of Rachel. Joseph isn't mentioned, I say, because he's already there in the land. Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. And of course these are from the handmaids. And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls. For Joseph was in Egypt already. So this gives a little resume of what we had in the book of Genesis, those who were there. Verse 6. And Joseph died at the age of 110, we found out last week, and all his brethren. Now let's see. All his brethren. I think we have a note down here. Yes, under verse 6. It says, Levi survived him about 23 years. make that little connection there, because we do have a connection very shortly here in the book of Exodus, and it is something that has bothered the Bible students quite a little bit. If you look at your chart sometime in the back of the companion Bible, especially chart 50, see something of the stretching out of these things, because we're going to soon find that a daughter of Levi was the mother of Moses. And she was his aunt. That is, I mean, Amram's aunt. Amram, the father of Moses, married his aunt, Jochebed. Well, we're anticipating a little bit, but keep that in mind. Now, when Jacob went down into Egypt, as we find here in the first verse, that was the beginning of the 215 years until the Exodus. Now, you'll see that makes things stretch quite a little bit through that time. And a lot of things happen we don't have anything about. We have very little history of what was happening to Israel over all those years after Joseph died, until Moses comes on the scene. We have some silence also about the wanderings in the wilderness. From the time that they failed at Kadesh Barnea, for the next 38 years we have hardly anything about what they were doing, where they were, and so on. We do have a list later on of the places they encamped. And of course, great many of those have disappeared today and we can't locate them. There are 18 of them. Now, how'd you like to move 18 times?
They didn't have plumbing
electricity at all. Yeah, but they had all their flocks and their herds and everything, their possessions and so on, to pack up and go. Take down the tent, set it up again, and so on. And with about 3 million people, that would be a terrific move each time they moved. Eighteen times. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied. Three words meaning about the same thing there. You have some notes on them. And waxed exceeding mighty. And the hand of God was with them. I'm going to take up a new paragraph. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. You have a note referring over to Isaiah, I think it's 54, somewhere like that, where it speaks of the Assyrian. And according to the histories and so on, this is firstly in keeping with what has been found out. That the dynasty of the actual Egyptian kings ended and an Assyrian king came on the throne. This doesn't mean particularly that Assyria had taken over Egypt. Egypt had become a great empire. But it was not unusual for a foreigner to come in and become a king. There was Joseph, was prime minister of Egypt for a long time. He was a foreigner. Daniel was high up in the court of Nebuchadnezzar and later on in the court of Cyrus. He was a Jew, a foreigner. And you could think of others that have done that sort of thing. And there is in kings, if you study history, you'll find that there are different times of kings who were actually foreigners. So this was an Assyrian king, and he didn't know Joseph. He'd never met him. He came into the kingship after Joseph had died and knew nothing of him. But he did see something that disturbed him. And he said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are the children of Israel. In verse 7, they have the word children of Israel, and it's sons, not children. And so in verse 1, I think that it's unfortunate that these words haven't been carefully distinguished between. The same thing is done in the New Testament. The sons and children have been mixed up. In the Greek, it would be huios and the technon, children. And you have two verses in the New Testament which are reversed. In John 1:12, instead of become the children of God, it's the sons of God. In Ephesians 1, where it is, should be children, they got a son. And so they mix them up. Now, a child, and of course, when we study Galatians, we find out that a child is one who is under servants. And even though he might be the heir, he still is no more than a servant till he comes of age. And so the words are used decisively. Now, under the Hebrew law, they were children until they become 12 years of age. And then they were the sons. And so he said, behold, the people are the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. So they had probably increased a great deal. And here would be a population greater than the Egyptian population. I don't imagine that the population of Egypt at that time was what we would call real dense. A great deal of their work was agricultural, and by irrigation, a great deal of it, raising their crops and so on. They had some cities, but not like big cities we have now. Their cities were not so very big. Now, if it is true that the people of Israel at that time were more than the Egyptians were, I wonder what it was some 40 years later. Yeah, 80 years later. Well, when Israel left Egypt, there was approximately, as near as we can guess, about 3 million Israelites left Egypt. Well, if the ratio is still on, the population of Egypt at that time would be less than 3 million. So you couldn't have great and mighty cities like we have today because many of our cities number in the millions. Well, that's just to kind of get an idea of a number. Come on, let us deal wisely with them. He's got a plan. He's going to deal wisely with them. Lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Now, there's two things he's afraid of. That they might outnumber them and join with an enemy, and also if they get out of the land. Or why doesn't he want them to get out of the land, you see? He got an iron curtain up? They can't get out? Well, really, yes, but it doesn't have to be an iron curtain. It isn't a bamboo curtain. It's a stone curtain. The wall is sure. Now, if you look up there at the map, over there at the delta of Egypt, and right to the right of it, you find there where the Isthmus of Suez is. And that wall of shore runs the whole length of it. Clear to the end of the Dead Sea, it sticks up there, the arm of the Red Sea. That was a wall of shore. And it had battlements all along, stations, and guards, garrisons, and so on. So that anybody who'd come from the north to invade Egypt would get stopped there at that wall, and Egypt to have at least a chance, a fighting chance. A little bit on the order of the Great Wall of China. That was the reason that was built, to keep out the hordes of the Mongolians to the north of them. So they built a mighty wall. You'll notice this wall mentioned a number of times in the Bible, so when you see Shur, S-H-U-R, mentioned, well, it's this great wall. You'll find it especially in the, as we had it back in Genesis, the story of Abraham and Hagar. And Hagar was going back to Egypt. She was an Egyptian, and she was heading for the wall of Shur. So they want them there. Well, why? And they good servants. They were, at this time, practically enslaved. Well, now they started that a little bit in the time of Joseph. You see, the king said the Egyptians abhorred animal husbandry, herdsmen, and told Joseph that they had any among their folks that were apt at this sort of work and needed a job, why they could take over the king's herds. So, well, there's one place. You'll find later on that not only were they herdsmen, but they also were in the building business. And they were doing a lot of building for Egypt. Now, whether the Israelites helped build any pyramids over in Egypt or not, I don't know. But they built storehouses and so on, and of course, archaeologists have found out that the Bible account is true. They found great storage houses built for grain, and they could tell right to the place in the wall where the Egyptians quit furnishing straw for the brick. The Israelites had to go out and gather up stubble and any old thing they could to mix with the clay to make the brick. They can find a place right in the wall where that happened. The bricks speak. They tell us something. That's right, the stones cried out. So here is the dilemma that the king of Egypt is facing. These might be more than they and might overcome them sometime. And if they might, get out of the land and they'd be out of their services. Wherefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. I suppose in a big job we have nowadays, we call them straw bosses. But they were equipped with whips. And they saw to it that nobody loafed on the job. In fact, they kept the men busy all day long. That was before the day of coffee breaks. And standing around at the water cooler, all that sort of thing. And it wasn't a day of 4 or 5 hours either. They worked. And it wasn't a 3-day week. Oh, just some of those things we need to think of. No doubt these Israelites here were working 7 days a week. The Egyptians didn't know anything about a Sabbath. And Israel didn't either. Yeah, they'd never heard of it. Not until they're out of the land and over to Mount Sinai did they ever hear about a Sabbath. First time it's ever recorded. Ever think of that? I don't know anything about the Sabbath. But we know of. No, it's the least about the seventh day, but doesn't use the word Sabbath. Yes. God rested from his work or ceased from his work on the seventh day. True. But it didn't call it a Sabbath. And didn't call it a day of rest as it is for to be within and under the law. He just ceased from his work. Yeah. And I look forward to a seventh millennium. Well, that's pretty well the subject, isn't it? The Sabbath was not instituted until the law was given at Sinai. Now, we do find that among the heathen peoples that they did have a day that they used for a special worship day for their idols and so on, and some of them did have 7 days. But the heathen in France, when they turned atheistic and so on, they made us a 10-day week. Didn't work out very well. Now, the Egyptians did have, at least in their later history, they did have a seventh day that they worshipped on or something, but it wasn't really the seventh day, it was the first day. Sunday, the worship of the sun. So, oh, rather interesting. And they afflicted them with their burdens. They didn't let anybody loaf. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities. Treasure. Now, treasure here could also mean granaries and the like for storing up food and the like. And those are Python and Ramses. We can locate those today. They're still there. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. Wouldn't that be natural? Hard-working people become a vigorous race. Now multiply and grow and so on. Whereas people are loafing and so on, the race degenerates. Number of children goes down and so on. And so the thing that they were trying to do just worked the opposite of what they were wanting to. And these people not only are great in number, but they're getting strong and vigorous. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel, a problem on their hands. But Egypt isn't the only country that has in history been grieved because of an alien population. It's one of the big problems in America today. And as you go back through the history of other countries, you find some of the same problems. And through history, you find various ways of them trying to settle the problems. All the way from deportation to mass murder and the like. It's still going on today. All you have to do is read in the paper what they're doing over in Cambodia, other places. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. They put in long hours. And probably up the work day week to 8 days instead of 7. And maybe 25-hour day. Well, at least. They really worked them. And that was bound to have its effects on Israel. Too much work. And of course, egregious. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field, such as taking care of their flocks and herds and so on. And their service when they made them serve was with rigor. That doesn't include some other things that were done too at the time. At the time that the people of Egypt, or Israel were in Egypt, they had great fishing business. Well, some of the Israelites were fishermen yet in the time of the Lord. There's Peter and some of the rest of the folks from up around Galilee. In fact, nearly all those Galileans are in the fishing business. And another thing, too, at the time that Israel were in Egypt, they had quite a trade with the Delta. Of course, remember, their cities were up the River Nile quite a way. And down in the Delta was where there was lots of waterfowl, the ducks and the geese and so on. And they liked this waterfowl very much. Doesn't seem that they went in for chickens, as we know them today. In fact, they're just not mentioned particularly there. We have them mentioned later in the New Testament, but not back in that time. And they had different ways of snaring these waterfowl and getting them on the tables to eat. But if they could snare them alive and put them in cages and take them up the river, why, they could keep them fresh. They had no refrigeration. But if they killed them, of course, why, the meat would spoil before they could get it up there for them to eat it. Now, they had different ways of snaring them. They had cages and fixed with a door and baited them with some grain and so on. And they'd go in and the door would go shut. But another way that they did was by diving. Scuba diving isn't anything new. These fellows had dived down below the surface where these birds were eating and grab them by the legs until they get a whole handful of them and then put them in a cage. That was another way of catching them. Now, how much the Israelites had to work in that, I don't know. But they got wise on this. They just couldn't get enough birds up the Nile River to satisfy all the rich tables that were spread at that time. And so they began putting in great hatcheries and hatched the eggs and raised little ones and had their meat. You know, you thought that hatcheries probably were something very modern, didn't you? Well, you know, they had everything at hand for it. They had caves, and they could hew out rock tables along the knees so that they could reach to them. They had stables where they kept their horses, and horse manure is just one of the finest things for producing heat. You put it in a layer and then put some sand on top of it. And so on these ledges, they would put horse manure and cover it with some sand and lay the eggs on top of that and turn them every day, like, of course, the hen or the one who lays the eggs do. They know enough to do that. And they'd hatch them out and raise the little ones until they got big enough to eat. And so they had a big poultry business going on in Egypt. And that was on a pretty large scale. Well, just a little bit of that to show that we aren't maybe so far advanced in some things as we think we are. At least they didn't have to worry about a power shortage in their hatcheries. All that sort of thing that happens nowadays. Well, going on. And the king of Egypt, this is verse 15, spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shifra, and the name of the other Puah. Now, don't get any idea here that there was only two midwives in Israel. These were the leaders, the main ones, because there were many of them. Now, we're going getting modern again today, and midwifery is coming back into prominence again in our own country. But at one time, it's practically forbidden, and that is in the last 100 years. Well, history repeats itself. Well, he spoke to these especially so that they could tell all the rest of them. What he said was this: when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the stools, the birth stools, if he be a son, then you shall kill him. But if he be a daughter, then you shall live. He's telling these Jewish midwives to commit murder. Of course, after the children are born, not before. But it's murder, whichever way it is. And you think these Hebrew women are going to do that very easily? But the midwives feared God. They respected God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men's children alive. And of course, naturally kept the girls alive too. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have you done this thing and have saved the men's children alive? Now these folks didn't lie in giving their answer. No doubt they were very correct. And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women. Here's the difference. The Egyptians are living in too much luxury because they had all these slaves working for them, and you see what it does to the race. But the Hebrew women are lively and are delivered ere or before the midwives come into them. They can have their children without the services of a midwife. And they were telling the truth. Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives. And the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. Still kept on multiplying. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, and he made them houses. That's homes, families. And of course, that was a blessing at that time to have a family, a big family. And Pharaoh charged all the people, all the Egyptians now. He's got another way of handling this. So he says, for all his people, the Egyptians, every son who is born, that is, of these Jews, if you see one, you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. Well, that's where we're left at the end of chapter 1. Sort of in the air. And there went a man of the house of Levi. Let me see, he was the third son of Jacob. And took to wife a daughter of Levi. Now we know from later on that this man was Amram, and that the daughter was Jochebed. So keep those names in mind. And the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. Now don't get any idea that this was her firstborn. She had 2 children before she had this one. And who were they? A boy and a girl. Miriam and Aaron, right. Miriam and Aaron. Both of those are older than Moses. It seems Moses has come in here about the time this edict is on, see? Probably the other two were a little older and they'd escaped it. And when she saw him that he was a goodly child, or says over in the New Testament, the proper child, which brings to us the idea right away, which is especially mentioned over in the New Testament, as Hebrews 11. And God had spoken to Amram and Jochebed and promised them a child. And when they saw that this was born, they realized that this was the one that God had promised. And that's the reason why that they did as they did. They hid him 3 months. And when she no longer hid him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes. That would be the papyrus plant. And it would be very floatable. And daubed it with slime and with pitch. And put the child therein. And she laid it in the flags as by the river's brink. Now the pitch there is bitumen. And by the way, as a usual thing, almost 100% of the time, when men find this oozing out of the ground, and there was slime pitch, down beside him, When they find just stuff oozing out of the ground, there's oil underneath. And so a number of years ago, when a man read this, he got an idea that down here in the land of Goshen in Egypt, there'd be oil. And it took him several years to get enough men interested to get us some capital together and drill. And sure enough, they got oil. There's oil wells there today. From reading the Bible, got the clue. Well, I know an interesting bit of history. And so this little ark was made very similar to Noah's ark. It was also caulked with bitumen or pitch, or we call it asphalt, so as to keep the waters of judgment out. And so she daubed the slime with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the reeds by the river's brink. And his sister, Miriam, stood afar off to know, to wit, to know what would be done to him. So she's keeping watch. She must be a girl of a few years, possibly around 12 years old or something like that, that is responsible enough to do a little work like this and use her mind, as we find she does a little later. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river. There must have been a bathing beach there then or something. And her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. Got curious to see what that was. And when she'd opened it, evidently it had been made up with a lid on top of it. She saw the child. And behold, the babe smiled. Well, and I'm just reading it like some people have read it. I know of two instances, know of two preachers that preached a sermon on this, and it was a smile, the power of a smile. And it should have been the power of a tear. And one of those preachers was an uncle of mine. This happened many, many years ago when I was just a youngster. My mother was just keen enough, and she caught it those times and kind of threw it up to them a little bit that they hadn't read it right. All right. The power of a tear, not of a smile. The babe wept. Now, he was more than 3 months old. And a baby that's more than 3 months old can put up quite a squawk, can't it? I wonder if there are just some tears oozed out from the eyes and no noise, or if the baby really cut loose and let it be known it was there. I rather imagine we could just say he cried. And, of course, the king's daughter wasn't just the type to pick him up and cuddle him. She wasn't quite that type. Probably rather young. And she had compassion on him. God saw to that. And she said, this is one of the Hebrew children. Well, how would she know? That'd be one thing. Or would it? Or had circumcision been instituted in the family of Moses yet? In Moses, of course. Now, Abraham was circumcised and so on, but we don't know whether the Israelites are doing this or not. You see, later on, Moses had a couple of sons. Why, there was a little difficulty about this business, and he and his wife about had a quarrel over it. In fact, I think she got so, I'm getting ahead of the story, and he sent her back home to her father while he took Israel out of Egypt. Well, would there be any other characteristic?
Shade.
Yeah. the Egyptians were Negroid and the Hebrews were not. So it'd be rather evident, even the small baby. Of course, now remember that small babies, even of the colored race, aren't always surreal black. Some of them are pretty black, but not all. Some of them are fairly fair until they develop a little more pigment later on. Then said his sister, now she must have approached to see when they were discovering this. Then said his sister Miriam to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew woman, that she may nurse a child for thee?" Aye, she's going to be very helpful, isn't she? I think for a girl, she did very, very well. She's making a suggestion. She had something in her mind, didn't she? Well, let's stop there and find out the next time just what did happen. That's a good place to stop a continuous story, isn't it? All right, we're ready to go again. I'm just about a minute here on this, so I'll have to watch the end of it, not waste time. Turn over to Galatians. We were in the midst of Galatians the last time. I think we got to 3:15, if I remember right. Galatians 3:15. We're in a difficult passage in Galatians, speaking of the law, its purpose, and its relation to the promise, and all of those things. And of course, a lot of that is not understood today, not knowing what the law was for in the case of Israel. Most of Christendom today has much idea of it, because they don't know what the law was for and how long it lasted and so on. They're trying to go by the law today. Well, there are a lot of questions that are made very plain in the Bible that Christendom just doesn't seem to know, even among people who claim to rightly divide the word of truth. There are not too many who know when the salvation of God was sent to the Gentiles. A great many do not really believe and know what John 3:16 means. And they don't know very much about the new creation. I was reading some commentary today just to get an idea or two, and man was talking about Romans 8, where if they have not the Spirit of Christ, they're none of his. And speaking of the Spirit of God and the Spirit of Christ and so on, and he was telling us that that was the Holy Ghost. Well, it is called the Holy Ghost, but he meant the person. But it's a new nature in one. And so there's been that great difficulty. And baptized with the Holy Ghost. Think of all the ideas that people have of that. Really don't know what it is. Yet the Lord told them very plainly that this baptism of the Holy Ghost is being endued with power from on high. There is a definition. Now you can take it there and go on. And so we have many, many questions like that. And Paul is trying to explain the law to these Galatians, and particularly to these Galatians, or most of them Gentiles he's talking to here. And he's trying to show them what the law did for Israel, because after all, they're partaking of Israel's blessings. And so they should know something about Israel and their problems and how they got things and so on. Not that they would get them the same way, but nevertheless, they were to know what the promises were and what the blessings were of Israel, because they would share in those. And so that is the problem. So he says in verse 15, "Brethren, I speak after the manner of men, that is, humanly speaking, though if it be but a man's covenant, yet if it be confirmed,